Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Schon viel über Kryptowährungen gehört, aber noch keinen richtigen Zugang gefunden? Der Einstieg in Kryptowährungen muss nicht kompliziert sein. Mit Xtrackers ETCs kannst du kostengünstig in die Zukunft investieren. Einfach übers klassische Depot. Auf xtrackers.de findest du viel Wissenswertes zu dieser spannenden Anlageklasse. Nimm deine finanzielle Zukunft selbst in die Hand. Schritt für Schritt mit Xtrackers. Investitionen unterliegen Risiken. Dieser Beitrag ist eine Werbemitteilung der DWS International GmbH, Frankfurt.
Immediately the rumors started.
The mysterious death of a legendary sports star.
There's this massive landslide of myth.
Legend of Tahti.
And somewhere in there is the truth.
Part of Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Namaste. I'm Devina Gupta. And on the show, we're talking about the health of US economy. Also looking at space travel industry and...
Maybe it took you 6 months to even remember that you had subscribed to something. So if companies can put off that cancellation decision, you might forget for another 6 months and continue paying for that product.
If that has happened to you, US government is trying to come to rescue. More on that story in a moment. But let's start with the United States, where it's been a busy week for economic data. Today, we had some more news on jobs, non-farm payrolls, which look at jobs added each month from the private sector and government agencies. We had data on hiring in that sector today, and the number of jobs added in August in those industries hit 142,000. Now, this is an important gauge to assess the health of the US economy, and this is less than expected. It all points to what economists call a cooling of the labor market, and it sparked concerns that there could be a recession on the cards as well. With the details, here's our North America business correspondent, Ritika Gupta.
The job print for August missing estimates coming in at 142,000 jobs being added. They were expecting 160,000. There are also downward revisions to the prior month as well. Remember, July was that big disappointment. So that was actually worse than previously thought. But there is an upside that unemployment rate did tick down to 4.2%. It's an terrible jobs report. And actually, that's what's complicating the debate even more of whether the Federal Reserve, when it meets later this month, that will cut borrowing costs by 25 or 50 basis points. And that was the big question. So clearly the labour market is softening, but the question really is about whether the Fed goes big later this month.
All right. So first, let's talk about those numbers. Rick Pulcinello joins me. He's the senior market strategist at the Franklin Templeton Institute. Thank you, Rick, for being with us. We're talking about the world's largest economy. And that's where this jobs report gets even more crucial. How are you reading it?
Yeah, and thanks for having me on. I think it's an important question. I don't know if we're any closer to kind of answering the 25 basis points or a quarter point versus a half point, which we're only, you know, call it a week and a half away from at this point. I think September 18th is the next Fed meeting. So when we look at the numbers, I mean, they are somewhat mixed, as you mentioned before. You know, you look at the downward revisions from the last couple of months at 86,000, you know, minus 86,000. And then you look at this month kind of coming in about 20,000 weaker than expected. That's kind of on the negative side of things. But also, as mentioned, the unemployment rate actually ticked lower. And it's mostly a rounding error. But last month it was 4.25%. This month it came in slightly lower at 4.22%. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we all know, when you look at that, you kind of have to dig under the hood a little bit and look at labor participation rate and kind of the breakdown even beneath that. That did held steady, though, month over month at 62.7%, I believe it was. So it's not as if there's, you know, a bunch of folks that have left the job force and then all of a sudden, you know, you kind of have a larger number there that's kind of, you know, tweaking things a little bit.
So for example, if you look at industry-wise, construction, mm-hmm. healthcare, manufacturing, and retail, what's your assessment? Where are the jobs coming down? And where is it that you're seeing more unemployment?
Yeah. So on the negative side of the ledger, I would definitely put manufacturing, retail, transportation, and IT. Those are kind of the big four that actually took away jobs. And then even on the positive side, you know, not to put a negative spin on it, but you could look at it and say, well, you know, even though there was numbers month over month that were positive, they were less positive than they have been. And I think two prime examples of that would be the education and then also the health sector. So kind of post-pandemic, those were where we were getting a lot of the good job gains in the non-farm payrolls number. Those have, they're both about half what they were the previous couple of months. So definitely a slowdown there, even though it's on the positive side of the ledger, it's still slower than it was. And then you also have things like leisure, hospitality, some contractual work, construction, as mentioned before. Those tend to have some seasonality involved. So even though they're on the positive side, they tend to be ones that don't fully indicate exactly what's going on with the labor market.
And does it also give an indication of wages, whether they are growing in some sectors versus the other?
Yeah, it does. So overall, it was 0.4% month over month in terms of wage gains. That does put the yearly number at about 3.8%, which is pretty healthy. If you look back historically, that's a actually really good number. Between the different sectors, not much has changed in terms of the makeup of that number. So I would just, you know, kind of step back and say 3.8%, very healthy month over month, 0.4%. I think the consensus expectation going into the report was 0.3%. So I would actually put that on the positive side of things.
All right. Then why is it that there is this fear of a slowdown and a talk of a U.S. economy going into recession? Because what we saw on the Wall Street today was that many investors were nervous. So just to get an outlook of what was happening, let's get in Chris Lowe, chief economist, FHN Financial, who's based in New York. Chris, how would you describe this Friday on Wall Street as the markets closed?
Yeah, I think the market focus was primarily on those job numbers rather than the unemployment rate. And there's a couple of things that really grabbed people's attention. One was the magnitude of the revision. The downward revision was 86,000. So, you know, that's almost three quarters of the job gain in the current month revised out of prior months. The other thing is that the Bureau of Labor Statistics also annually revises the numbers, and they've previewed, they expect to revise those numbers down by about 818,000 over the course of a year. That works out to an additional downward revision, if it holds up, of about 65,000 jobs a month. So you can see how these job gains we've been getting, it can melt away very quickly with revision.
What would that also mean for the borrowing costs for the company? Because this job data is also linked with the U.S. central bank's decision whether or not to cut rates. So earlier, we heard from Federal Reserve Governor Christopher Wallace, who said it's important for the U.S. central bank to begin cutting interest rates this month with rising risks of further weakening in the labor market. Here's what he was saying at a U.S. college.
When we faced a period of banking instability in the spring of 2023, there were calls from some to stop rate hikes, despite inflation running over 5%. When inflation fell unexpectedly in the second half of last year, we did not overreact and immediately cut the policy rate. And then when inflation accelerated in the first quarter of this year, we did not overreact and raise rates despite some calls for us to do so. I believe our patience over the last 18 months has served us well. But the current batch of data no longer requires patience. It requires action.
So we've talked about the mixed data from the jobs report. This is the signal coming from the U.S. Federal Reserve Governor Christopher Wallace. And that's the question with you, Rick, because the Federal Reserve has maintained its policy rate in the current range of 5.25% to 5.5%. And for the last 4 years, there are expectations that there could be a first rate cut in September when they meet in mid-September. Is it a question now? Not if there'll be a rate cut, it seems that there is a signal for that, but by how much?
Yeah, I think that is the primary question now. I think, you know, it's almost a foregone conclusion. I hate to say that, but it's almost a guarantee that they're going to ease policy through a rate cut again when they meet in, you know, call it 11 days, 12 days from now. I think the question is by how much, right? And does today's report, you know, coupled with what you saw with, this was a big week for the U.S. labor market in terms of reports. Besides the revisions that he just mentioned, there was also the JOLTS. Initial jobless claims came out last week, and then we had another ADP number yesterday, probably not as relied upon as non-farm payrolls that we saw this morning. But I think that's the question, right? Is it going to be 25 basis points or is it going to be 50 at that September 18th meeting? I would say it's going to be close. And I think the reason for that is if you look at how the market is pricing it right now, they are expecting about 100 basis points or a full 1% of easing by the end of this year. It gets a little complicated because there is no meeting in October. Mm. And if you look at when the November meeting is, it's actually the day after the election here in the U.S. So if they want to get that 100 basis points, it could be 50 September 18th, and then it could be that additional 50.
The 1% is what your guess is. Chris, is that the number that will make investors confident?
Well, it's certainly the number investors are expecting at the moment. But, you know, I think it was really interesting, the market reaction this morning, because initially the market rushed to price in a half point cut. And it was only after Chris Waller said, one, yes, he supports a rate cut at the coming meeting, but the pace and the magnitude of cuts should depend on future information. And again, that's his opinion, not necessarily the whole Federal Reserve, but the market pretty quickly retreated back to expecting a quarter point cut. So, yeah, I think Rick is spot on here that the market's expecting a full percent by the end of the year.
Briefly then, Rick, this talk of a slowdown and a fear of recession in the U.S. economy, is this economy any closer to that?
Yeah, I don't want to say it's imminent because honestly, if you look at kind of the big three, and obviously the Fed has the dual mandate of maximum employment and price stability. You know, if you look at what they've done, and again, you mentioned this before, going from essentially zero for an interest rate on the front end of the curve to over 5%, right? 5.25 to 5.5 being the target Fed funds rate that we're seeing right now. They obviously did that in response to COVID, right? They had seen inflation go from, call 1.6, 1.7%. Spiked up to about 5.6%, right? And they had to raise rates, or they felt they had to raise rates. So that number is now, if you look at core or headline inflation, right? Whether you're talking about what you pay at the grocery store and the gas pump, whether that's included or not included, that number now, that inflation number is more like 2.5 or 2.6%, depending on the measure that you're looking at. So not mission accomplished, but certainly a lot of progress in that area. The other one that we always look at, obviously we've been talking about the employment report, but the one that's kind of outside their mandate would be GDP growth. So if you look at the first quarter in the U.S., GDP growth came in, it was pretty small at 1.4%. But the second quarter number was actually two times that. The initial read was 2.8%. And then after an upward revision, we're now at 3%. So I would say if those are the three kind of legs of the stool, they're all in pretty good shape at this point. I don't think the stool's about to fall over.
And the fourth one, which may be the U.S. elections, who knows what surprises are there. But Rick Pulcinello, thank you so much for joining us, senior market strategist at the Franklin Templeton Institute. Chris, be with us because we want to talk a lot more about the U.S. elections and also space travel. That's what we want to talk about with you. But now let's head to another big story, which was breaking earlier in the day. The owner of 7-Eleven, a convenience store, has rejected a buyout offer from a Canadian convenience store giant. And this is a deal that's been snubbed that likely would have been the largest foreign-led acquisition of a Japanese company. River Davis is a reporter for New York Times in Tokyo and explained all this to my colleague Vishala earlier.
In Japan, the convenience store, as it's called in Japanese, konbini, is often called a national treasure. They are kind of a big part of the society's infrastructure here. They have a ton of fresh food, around 3,000 products per store, and people really rely on them for a number of their day-to-day activities. You can get your bills there, you can pick up government documents and packages. So there's a really large kind of repeater base for these convenience stores, such as 7-Eleven. Frequently, you talk to people that, you know, will step inside a 7-Eleven for various purposes, 3-4 times a day even. So they're really kind of held in high regard in Japan.
And this takeover bid, not entirely surprising that takeover bids of Japanese companies are now coming to the surface, given what the yen is doing. Why was it rejected?
So the independent board that 7&I, the operator of 7-Eleven, set up to examine this deal replied in a letter to Couche-Tard sent earlier today saying basically that the deal grossly undervalued 7-Eleven's value as a company. So management is trying to project to shareholders that it is capable of increasing the value of 7-Eleven without kind of accepting a bid from Couche-Tard. The other problem that they flagged with Couche-Tard's takeover bid is they think that it could likely face regulatory issues in the United States because 7-Eleven and Couche-Tard are actually the largest convenience operators in that country.
Do you think that this still has legs in it, or do you think it might open the door for other companies to come along and think they might be able to get a bit of the 7-Eleven action?
This does certainly open the door, perhaps not for another takeover bid, although Couche-Tard could come back with a more kind of lucrative offer. But certainly 7-Eleven has been under pressure for years from activist shareholders that have said that it suffers from conglomerate discount, meaning that all of the businesses that it has together are worth less than they really should be. So they've faced pressure from some activists to really focus just on the 7-Eleven convenience store brand and kind of do away with other businesses that it owns, such as, you know, supermarket chains in Japan. So certainly, I think going forward, 7&I management will face a lot more pressure to kind of reorganize its business and show shareholders that it's taking steps to really increase its corporate value. And that's been a broader trend that we've seen amongst Japanese companies broadly over the past few years. Regulators here in Tokyo have really pushed companies to put a higher priority on returning value to shareholders than they have in the past.
When was the last time you went to a 7-Eleven?
I have to say, I literally went to 7-Eleven for lunch today to pick up a salad. I was filing a couple stories and I didn't have time to cook. And it just shows you how widely we all rely on these 7-Elevens for fresh food.
Well, that's River Davis speaking to my colleague Vishala earlier. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, have you subscribed recently to a streaming service or a video game service or a meal service? And what happens when you want to cancel that subscription? Well, many a times I've forgotten to cancel subscription. And then when I come down to it, it's very hard to get a company to get it removed. And for many companies, they're also profiting from consumer forgetfulness. And this is all part of the subscription economy. So, Savannah Amar from our US partners Marketplace explored this.
In the early days of the pandemic, Florencia Murata Wergler was missing her gym time.
I have three kids at home. I need to just channel my energy in some way. And so I signed up for some different exercise classes.
A virtual sampler of cardio workout trial subscriptions that started out free, then automatically renewed, and kept billing Murata Wergler's credit card long after she'd forgotten.
I canceled the peskiest one just 2 weeks ago. We've had this long relationship that I didn't even know about.
Murata Wergler is an expert on fine print. She studies internet contracts at the NYU School of Law, and she still falls victim to this kind of stuff.
In so many ways and so many times.
So she says the rest of us don't stand a chance, especially when companies make it frictionless to sign up for subscriptions, but cumbersome to cancel.
You have to go through many different pages, try to get a human on the loop. There are many different stages where you're being asked whether you're sure.
These are all tactics that prevent consumers from making choices that cost firms money. Economists have a name for those of us who keep our finances on autopilot.
These inattentive consumers.
Ben Klopak is a professor at Texas A&M. He co-authored research finding that companies that use a subscription model can count on as much as a 200% revenue boost from this kind of consumer spaciness. And it helps if customers have to jump through hoops once they do cancel.
maybe it took you 6 months to even remember that you had subscribed to something. So if companies can put off that cancellation decision, you might forget for another 6 months and continue paying for that product.
Well, that's not a really good way of doing business, quite honestly.
Teresa Murray is with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. She says the Biden Federal Trade Commission's click-to-cancel rule would require companies to make ending a recurring subscription no harder than signing up. So if you can enroll online in 3 steps, you should be able to opt out online in 3 steps. And in some cases, companies would have to remind subscribers before automatically renewing. Murray expects the proposed rule to be finalized in the coming weeks, but already.
Companies are trying to get out in front of it because they probably know that the rules are going to change, or it just is good PR for them.
And as companies make those changes, which are popular with consumers, Murray says competitors are pressured to fall in line. Still, she says the best way to limit unwanted charges is to steer clear of subscriptions to begin with. Easier said than done, with so many temptations out there. Like, you sign up for a service to watch one movie or read one article, and you mean to cancel afterward.
It's embarrassing. I wanted to make a meme, and so I signed up for a meme-making platform, and it's now like 3 months later, and I've made one meme.
Yahya Mokhtrizadeh founded Truebill, now called Rocket Money, an app that promises to help with forgotten subscriptions. Users hand over their credit card information, and the service tracks down recurring charges.
That initial aha moment, when they first get the app and they see their dashboard for the first time, and they're just shocked at how much they're paying for.
That dashboard report is free. You can get Rocket Money to Brave Cancellation Hotline for you for a minimum of $6 a month, automatically renewing, of course.
When you put it that way, it does sound funny, a subscription management app that's a subscription, right?
But Mokhtrizadeh says it comes with lots of other features, like a budgeting tool, and you can try it out first with a 7-day free trial. Maybe just set yourself a reminder to cancel it.
Samina Amar, with that advice from a U.S. partner marketplace. Chris, you've gone through it as well, isn't it? Please tell me that you have, because I don't want to be the only one who's forgotten to cancel a subscription.
Are you kidding me? I'm sitting here listening to the story and thinking, oh, man, I forgot to cancel my son's Netflix that he's no longer using. So I'll have to do that when we get off the phone.
Well, yeah, you better do that. But while I'm sitting here and I'm also getting a direct feed from the U.S. space agency NASA. And as we speak, the U.S. plane maker Boeing is looking forward to its Starliner spacecraft heading back to Earth, but without its original passengers and these people at NASA with their computer screens in front of them. And there's a diagram of the space shuttle also. They're following this path very closely. Now, astronauts Suni Williams and Butch Wilmore will be staying behind on the International Space Station because this capsule, which has suffered technical problems after it launched with NASA, has been deemed too risky to take them home. So with us is now Richard Tribu, who is a space reporter at Orlando Sentinel Media Group. Thanks so much, Richard, for joining us. First, tell us what are we expecting this flight path to be?
Hi, thanks for having me. It's slated to undock from the International Space Station in just about 10 minutes from now. It has a 6-hour flight return home, targeting a landing in the desert in the White Sands area of New Mexico. And then after that, they're going to ship it back to Kennedy Space Center, where Boeing's factory is for the Starliner, and go over all the data and see if they can fix all of the problems that they found on the flight up when it went up there back in June.
Yes, but what does it say about this project? Because Boeing was awarded $4.2 billion contract in 2014 by NASA. And it seems to be that Starliner has not performed as it was expected to. What's the future of it that you see now?
That's a good question. The 4.2 has actually climbed to 4.6 billion over time, and they're still under contract to provide 6 flights of regular ferry service, if you will, flying up 4 astronauts and cosmonauts, combination up to the ISS and back for these 6-month runs, SpaceX being the other partner that was awarded the money for that. I found out recently that NASA's already paid them close to, I think about $2.8 billion of that $4.8 billion for development costs, et cetera. But that said, Boeing still has spent $1.6 billion more than they expected to for development. So they're under the weather. However, there's still $2 billion out there that Boeing could earn if they were to fix the problems with the Starliner. It's not a great look for Boeing. They've got plenty of other issues on their plate. But NASA likes the vehicle. They just wish that all the little parts that have failed on this trip were a little bit more reliable.
Yeah.
They actually were discussed this week that they thought that they understand mostly what the problem is, and they expect to not necessarily replace the parts on it, but maybe
come fix it. But at the same time, because as the story runs through as well, Chris, it's the investors also who are watching how Boeing is performing, and it's the last thing that they need after all the security concerns over its commercial airplanes.
Well, I think what you'll find is that if Boeing lets their investors know that there's a clear path forward with NASA letting them actually move forward with these missions, and that remains to be seen, then they stand to actually earn $2 billion that they wouldn't have otherwise. That said, they're still going to have to spend more than that $1.6 billion they've had in overruns today. And so it's up to Boeing's new CEO to determine whether they're going to stick with the contract or not. But NASA's administrator indicated recently that he spoke to Boeing's new CEO and that he feels 100% that they are going to move forward. That's what he said.
White Knight and all of this seems to be SpaceX, owned by tech billionaire Elon Musk, which is slated to bring the two astronauts who've been stuck at the International Space Station back in February then, Richard.
Yeah, and SpaceX has expanded their original contract, which was only $2.6 billion compared to Boeing's, and they've added on now for up to 14 flights. They're up to $5 billion for those 14 flights.
Yes.
Unfortunately, they can't use two of the seats for this one coming up later this month so that Butch and Sonny can have a ride home next February. But you got to know that Elon Musk is happy to have his company shine while Boeing is not shining so hot right now.
All right, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. That's Richard Tribu, space reporter at Orlando Sentinel Media Group. And as always, it's been a pleasure to speak with you, Chris. Chris Lowe, chief economist, FHN Financial, based in New York. You've been with World Business Report. See you next time. Namaste.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where is the value?
From the AI revolution...
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast, but we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.